It's the Burt Cohen Show. History. Who owns history? Who owns patriotism? What is the truth? There's a lot of interpretations, a lot of changes that go on as history is made and for many years afterwards. We're going to ask today about the right, the Tea Party, and their claim to be the real patriots. What is their agenda? Are they really patriots, or are they something else? Our guest today is Robert Perry, an investigative journalist. Nice title. Boy, there's not enough of that going around, I'll tell you. He was awarded the George Polk Award for National Reporting in 1984 for his work with the Associated Press on the Iran-Contra story and uncovered Oliver North's involvement in it as a Washington-based consultant for Newsweek. In 1995, Perry established Consortium News as an online e-zine dedicated to investigative journalism. Perry has written several books, including Lost History, Contras, Cocaine, The Press, and Project Truth. He also wrote Secrecy and Privilege, The Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. His new book is America's Stolen Narrative. Well, Robert, thanks for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show.
Thanks, Bert.
There is no debate. As you point out, the right hates government. Perry argues that its cries of liberty are really just reflective of the same cry for liberty by those who fought for their liberty to own, yes, own other human beings. They want to take down the federal government, not for reasons stated, but really out of the same tradition of white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant male rule. Our guest, Robert Perry, suggests that right-wing extremists have always employed historical revisionism and various other dishonesties to promote their ideological fictions. Well, again, thanks for being with us. The Tea Party took their name from American patriotic history, and they've adopted the 18th century tricorn hat and the clothing of the time. They clearly intend to own patriotism, and in so doing, make everyone who opposes them appear to be anti-patriotic. And I'll tell you, in the late 60s, we who opposed the war in Vietnam somehow allowed the right to kind of own the flag, and that was a huge mistake. And we'll see if that's being made again. In his article on Alternate, as in many other places, Perry argues that there has been a specific, in his words, effort to anchor the angry anti-government positions in the traditions of U.S. history. Perry argues it just isn't so. Robert, you say that the Tea Party has an ideological hatred of government. Those are pretty strong words. I wonder if you could describe what you mean.
Well, I think the Tea Party has made it pretty clear that they oppose the idea of a strong federal government. It's been a central tenet to their ideology. They favor a more states' rights oriented, the devolution of the federal power back to the states, and they assert that this is what the framers of the Constitution envisioned.
Well, there was a lot of debate going on at the time back in the 18th century, the late 18th century, and you know it's pretty well known that the Tea Party has adopted the old War of Independence yellow flag. You know, the one says "Don't tread on me." See that whenever you see the Tea Party. What was the original meaning of that flag? Is the 21st century Tea Party use in concert with that original meaning?
Well, no. Of course, The original idea was to oppose the rule of King George III over the colonies, over the American colonies, and the denial of any representation for those colonies in the British Parliament. So the idea was for the revolutionary movement at that time was to achieve a separate, independent country, the United States, and the "Don't Tread on Me" was not directed at the American government; it was directed at the British Crown. And in fact, once the Constitution was enacted in 1788, there were uprisings. There was actually one right before it too, the Shays Rebellion, right, which occurred in 1786 and 1787, and then the Whiskey Rebellion, which occurred in the 1790s. And people like Sam Adams were asked, you know, why are you supporting the putting down of these rebellions by dissident Americans? And his response, and the response from other of the founders, well, there's a difference. There's a profound difference between opposing foreign control without representation and opposing your own republic, that within your own republic, you need to work things out differently. You just can't have rebellions. So that was the view of the founders. There was very much there wasn't this idea that people should be in rebellion against their own country, and in fact, the Constitution of the United States declares that to be treason.
Well, it wasn't without some form at the time. It was still sort of in the process of formation, the country, and my understanding of those, the Whiskey Rebellion and the Shays Rebellion, that those and countless other farmer-debtor rebellions, was that part of the struggle was between the wealthy creditors who had lent money to pay for the War of Independence. They had financed the war. They wanted the money back with interest. And on the other side were debtors who were mainly farmers. And the debtors certainly preferred state sovereignty as over a centralized federal government, which would likely be a lot easier on them, as state governments are naturally more responsive to the popular sentiment because they're that much closer to them, while the creditors insisted on federal authority to guarantee they'd get their money back. So the sense was that if the 13 state legislatures could not muster the fortitude to crack down on the delinquent debtors and taxpayers, some of the wealthy class reason, well, they'd create a national government that could. So it seems that the tension between the political power of the few wealthy creditors and the many common debtors has continued really since our founding. Is this something that the Tea Party talks about, the concentration and centralization, not just of political power, but of wealth power as well? What side would the Tea Party come down on in this struggle between creditors and debtors?
Well, I'm not sure that question is posed quite the same way with the modern Tea Party. However, I mean, a key point is, and this is where I think the much of this misunderstanding of early American history comes from, is that the country was governed from 1777 to 1787 by the Articles of Confederation. Now, the Articles of Confederation it contained in Article 2 of them the declaration that the states were sovereign and independent. There wasn't really even a federal government. They called it a League of Friendship. And this was the frame that was established in Philadelphia in 1777, and it was there through the Revolution and then through the first years of independence, first years after the war was over. Now, the Articles failed miserably. They were particularly abhorred by General George Washington, who had seen how they affected his troops. They left them often without supplies because the states would renege on agreements to provide money or materiel for his soldiers. So he was particularly opposed to it. And then after the British recognized American independence in 1783, the country was essentially falling apart. Its fragile independence was in grave jeopardy. And you had things like the Shays Rebellion in 1786 and early 1787, which the federal government could not respond to. And in fact, although Washington was very concerned about that, he thought perhaps the British were behind it. I don't think they were, but he thought that's what he was suspicious mm-hmm. of. And so some of his former leaders of the Continental Army, including General Knox and General Clinton, organized a special force to go put down the rebellion, which was put down in early 1787, shortly before the Constitutional Convention is held in Philadelphia. And so what happens then is that with Madison as sort of a protege of Washington at that point, and with Hamilton, another protege of Washington, they construct a major concentration of power in the central government.
Right.
They essentially strip the states of their sovereignty and independence and move the sovereignty to we the people of the United States. And in fact, Madison, even though he's often cited by the Tea Party people as sort of one of their own, he favored an even stronger central government. He wanted to have the federal government to have the power to veto any state law of its choosing. So that was rejected in the Constitutional Convention, and instead the federal courts could throw out a state law if it was deemed unconstitutional. So the Constitution and federal law were deemed the supreme laws of the land. But what happened in Philadelphia and was understood at the time by people who were opposed to it was a major shift of power from the states to the central government. It was a centralizing of authority, the biggest in American history. So that's what the struggle was at the time of the ratification. And in the South, there was particular concern that having a central government, mm-hmm. a strong central government, would eventually lead the central government to abolish slavery. And that was the fight that Madison confronted at the ratification convention in Virginia in 1788, where Patrick Henry and George Mason, among others, the Anti-Federalists, argued that inevitably, by ceding this much power to the central government, which they felt would eventually become dominated by the North, that would mean the end of slavery. They also felt that their militias would be taken over, federalized by, or could be federalized by the executive, the president, and that could in turn prevent them from maintaining slavery by force and responding to slave rebellions. And that sort of resistance to slavery. So that was the framework of that time. But to pretend that the Constitution was somehow designed to create a states' rights-oriented system is simply bad history. It's not what was done. It's not what Madison and Washington and Hamilton and others set out to do, and it's not what they did.
If you just tuned in to the Burt Cohen Show, our guest today, Robert Parry, investigative journalist, he established Consortium News in 1995. We're talking about the patriotism or not of the Tea Party. They wear their alleged patriotism on their sleeve. They want to use that quite a bit, but it does, you know, as you describe it, Robert. It sounds like. I mean, they talk about a devolution of power nowadays in the 21st century. And as you describe the struggles back then at the founding of these currently United States, it seems like the same argument in a way is going on, except instead of the Confederacy making the argument for a devolution of power, it's something called the Tea Party. Is that... somewhat in line with your analysis of the situation?
Yes, I think what you see happening then in the early days after the Constitution is ratified, and fairly narrowly, by the way, it was not an overwhelming vote. There was grave concern about it. It passed narrowly in some of the key states, including Virginia.
Right.
And then there grew over time resistance from the particularly from the southern states to anything that the federal government might do. For instance, Madison, who begins to shift more toward his plantation neighbors, his slave-owning neighbors, including Thomas Jefferson. But you know, he had favored, he talks about this in the Federalist Papers, using the Commerce Clause, which he wanted to put in, it was his idea, to give the federal government control over national commerce to build roads and canals and essentially infrastructure.
Right.
And at one point, Jefferson sort of mocks him. And Jefferson was arguing, as were many of the plantation owners, that they wanted to have as weak a federal government as possible,
yes.
even after they lost the battle over ratification. So you have this effort to prevent the federal government from doing many things that the so-called Federalists, Washington and Hamilton, become more of the Federalist grouping, and they want to use the government to build a nation. Ironically, there are times when, even after Jefferson wins the presidency, he uses the federal government in a very powerful way, for instance, with the purchase of the Louisiana Territories, which is certainly not one of the enumerated powers given the federal government in the Constitution, but he did it anyway. And so, and of course, Madison was at the heart of that as a Secretary of State. So so you have this sort of, it's not a clean or even, it's a bit of a zigzag sort of movement as we follow this through history. But as we move into the 19th century, you start seeing more the South resisting any effort to build the federal government, because for the main concern that they feel that if the federal government is doing more things, even things like disaster relief, that will eventually set the stage for the elimination of slavery.
Right.
And in fact, they turn out to be sort of correct. The fears of Patrick Henry and George Mason in 1788 do materialize. The North eventually does become much stronger. The country sort of turns against slavery, at least in the North. The idea of the U.S. being a major international figure is hampered by this continuation of this barbaric practice and the divisions that it causes throughout the new territories, Kansas and Missouri and so forth. So you have this tension that leads eventually to the secession of the 11 southern slave states and the Civil War. And when the South is forced back into the Union through the Civil War and slavery is eradicated, the effort doesn't stop there. The old Southern aristocracy reorganizes under segregation and the Jim Crow laws and basically to put down the blacks using the Ku Klux Klan and other means. And again, as we see, we move toward the more modern times, there's the continued resistance to the federal authority, because the fear is that the federal authority will destroy this system of segregation just as it had destroyed the earlier system of slavery. And, of course, again, that's what eventually happens when you get to the 1950s and 60s with the Civil Rights Movement. The federal government again steps in and says you're not going to be allowed to treat African-American citizens this way. And so the South has been resisting that and is quite angered by it. And that anger continues to the present day.
Yes.
You then see, starting in the late 1960s, Richard Nixon developing the so-called Southern Strategy, which was to pull the old segregationist, white segregationist South into the Republican Party. It's a brilliant move politically.
Mm-hmm.
He ultimately does bring those states into the Republican column. Ronald Reagan in 1980 sort of reasserts that. He opens up his national campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi, the place where there was a famous atrocity against three civil rights workers. So ultimately, the white segregationist South becomes the base of the modern Republican Party. And that's where we are today. The Tea Party does talk in terms of some libertarianism, that is speaking against any government intervention in the economy. But a large part of its base comes from this very dissatisfied white population, angered about these changes that have occurred that have diminished white supremacy in the country, that have led to a much more multicultural society
that
is now personified by having a black man in the White House.
Wow, you covered a lot of points there, and I think it's a very, very sound argument. And I find it interesting in reading American history that one of the arguments, and it's fascinating to me that the argument between state versus federal sovereignty continues to this day and is absolutely at the core of the right wing, the Tea Party, and what the Republican Party now is. One of the arguments involved, as you mentioned, capital improvements. Centralized wealthy interest drove expansion of the railroads. Those particular moneyed interests wanted to, get the resources that there were in the West and the Northwest. Lincoln was a big part of that, of expansion of the railroads, which resulted in more political power in the hands of the owners of those tools for resource extraction, and that drove a lot of the westward expansion. FDR, much, much later, invested massive capital in capital improvements, which greatly benefited the entire country, not just the wealthy, but greatly enhanced and built a middle class. And in its,
I think that there's an important parallel that goes to this what I talked about in terms of the history of slavery and segregation. There develops an alliance. It's sort of an alliance of interest. In the latter part of the 19th century, between the Southern aristocracy that doesn't want federal involvement in its new institution of sort of a quasi-slavery, segregation, Jim Crow, et cetera.
Yeah.
And you have the Northern industrial interests, which, the robber barons.
Yes.
And of course, Lincoln was a lawyer for the railroads before he became president, and even during the Civil War, he begins this initiative of expanding the railroads across the country,
mm-hmm.
the transcontinental railroads. So you have many of the early, the great wealth that we see from Vanderbilt and Carnegie and Rockefeller and so forth derives from that expansion. And those figures also do not really want, they enjoy having the federal government help them out in terms of setting up these railroads. They don't want the federal government or any government interfering with them making huge amounts of money and buying politicians with it.
Yes.
So you see this great resistance to in the latter part of the 19th century and early 20th century to reforms. That's why the robber barons opposed Teddy Roosevelt, because he represented certain kinds of reforms in terms of imposing federal law on them to restrict the damage they were doing to the country, to its people. And so you have this sort of rough alliance between the laissez-faire capitalists and the white aristocracy in the South, both not wanting this idea of federal interference in what they're doing. Now, that really goes on up to the various, there are a lot of Wall Street problems, various crashes that occur in the late 19th century and into the 20th, and then, of course, the Great Depression starting in 1929. That is the game changer, because Roosevelt is able to come in with massive public support to finally restrain what Wall Street did,
yes,
to put the country back to work, and to begin to use the federal government much more to the benefit of the broad population, and that's a big part of the struggle we also see now. What you're seeing, and you're seeing this reappear now, As the American public forgot about the Great Depression, as people died off who went through that, as we sort of became sort of
distant,
casual about much of that effort to improve the state of the American people and the building of the middle class that came out of it,
yeah,
you get to this period of the 1970s and early 1980 with Reagan's presidency, and you see again now this reemergence of this alliance that we saw in the late 19th century appearing in the later part of the 20th century, and that is between people in the South who don't like the idea of the federal government telling them they have to serve black people in restaurants,
right,
and the libertarians who say the government should be out of the economy, we should have total free markets, get rid of regulation, and so forth. So that has then, that sort of reemerged in the Reagan years and continued, and then reached a certain point with George W. Bush where again, more and more regulations are being shed, and we came crashing into the so-called Great Recession. So, but the Tea Party has now sort of become the foot soldiers of that combined movement, a movement of sort of resistance and animosity toward the increasing power of people of color in the United States, and the idea that the federal government should look out for the general welfare of the American people. Those two elements have now come together again with the Tea Party and with the people like the Koch brothers,
yes,
these industrialists in the Midwest, who are helping to fund it.
Yeah, that connection between the moneyed interests behind the Tea Party, the Koch brothers, are the most obvious. You know, I'm certainly reminded of the robber barons at the in the 1880s, 1890s, who just wanted to run everything. And as you were talking about the connection they had in tying in very conveniently with the populist anger, and you know, I'm reminded a little bit, at least to some degree, of, well, after the Great War, now known as the First World War, the German economy was crushed, just decimated by the winners. And there was a massive wave of populist anger. Now, funding this anger were the big industrialists who manipulated the National Socialist Movement, Nazism, for its own ends. I wonder if there's, obviously the racism that was there in Germany at the time, there's clearly some degree of, as with so many different issues, white Protestant male control. And, you know, in the South, let's face it, the Ku Klux Klan and those interests who wanted to favor Jim Crow, again, it was white Protestant male domination and control. What of the money behind the populist Tea Party movement? Do the people in the Tea Party movement, do they recognize that they're being foot soldiers for these new wealthy powers?
Well, I'm not sure they do. I obviously, you can't. You probably have to talk to all of them to get a sense. I have not spoken with that many of them, but there are certain parallels, and some parallels I think one has to sort of resist. But an interesting element here, and this goes back to why I started actually doing reporting. I usually do reporting on more current things than the American Revolutionary period, but what I kept confronting when I would try to write about certain elements of this is a very sophisticated false narrative that was being created by the modern right, which, you know, elements of that used to use Confederate symbols for their resistance to the federal government. That is the Confederate battle flag, you know, the South will rise again.
Right.
Those kinds of things were sort of what those of us growing up in the 50s and 60s were familiar with in terms of this kind of sort of populist anger against the federal government, especially focused in the South. That got changed. There was a rebranding, if you will, of the right away from the Confederate flag to the Tea Party flag, or the Don't Tread on Me flag, and as well as going from going to other symbols of the revolutionary period. But with that came a rewriting of the founding narrative. And essentially, right-wing scholars, who I think were pretty well paid for their work, would go back and cherry-pick quotes here and there out of the Federalist Papers or some were apocryphal, but they would grab quotes out of context and then recreate what the framers were doing. So they transform what happened in 1787 from being an effort to centralize power in the federal government, which is what it undeniably was, and was recognized both by people for it and against it to be that.
Right.
They changed that to be that the framers came together to set up a states' rights-oriented system with a weak federal government, and that's exactly false. But they would find a few quotes here and there which they would cite, especially they'd use some of Madison's quotes that were taken out of context, and they recreated the narrative. They created a false narrative, and then they convinced some of these folks who are not very familiar with this history to buy into it. So you had people who are well-meaning, thinking that they're really standing with the framers of the Constitution, you know, against a strong central government, not knowing that the framers of the Constitution engaged in the greatest centralizing of power in the United States in the federal government. So what you have here is sort of an interesting way of sort of proving Orwell's point that he who controls the present controls the past, and he who controls the past controls the future. So that's sort of why I sort of had to go back, and I spent some time the last couple of years going back and not just reading the Federalist Papers again, but also the Anti-Federalist Papers, and then we also went back in looking at the Second Amendment, which became this falsification of that narrative is very important. It was not meant to be a libertarian right of individuals. It was actually a concession to the states. The states were very concerned that they were losing control of their militias, and that's why you get the preamble about a well-regulated militia necessary for a free state. It was, and bearing arms, what didn't mean that you could personally carry weapons, although that was not a particular concern at the time. It was bearing arms meant you could join a militia, you could be part of a militia. That's how Madison used the term. So what you've had is a very consistent and serious effort from sort of modern day right wing scholars to go back to back 230, 240 years and rewrite our history, and then use that to convince people today that they should be almost violently, in a revolutionary spirit, you know, treating their republic as if it's the crown of England, and wanting to engage in warfare against it.
Yeah.
That's where we seem to be moving. But people should know that it's based on a false history that they've been sucked into.
Well, people, have their emotions and frustrations. People work hard. They don't have time to look into history, to read history, oftentimes. And so oftentimes, people just accept what they're fed, like a commercial on TV, and haven't questioned it. And you raise some very, very good points. And it seems that one of the goals of the moneyed interest behind the Tea Party, they want to manipulate the history and get themselves in charge. Isn't one of their goals really plutocracy, government of, by, and for the very rich, which is completely incompatible with a republican form of government? Or does the Tea Party actually support the destruction of a republican form of government? Do they favor imposition of a plutocracy, or haven't they thought about that? What's your sense, Robert Perry?
Well, I'm not sure they really thought it through, because I think there's a lot of just muddled thinking that has gone into this. Essentially, a lot of, and some others have written about this. I think Matt Taibbi did some interesting work on this, where he went to some of the Tea Party rallies and he found out that a number of these Tea Partiers would be they were like the first ones to get their Medicare finance scooters, and you know, they'd be at these rallies going around in scooters that were being paid for by the federal government.
Right.
So there was this, there's sort of this very confused attitude. It's almost, but there, which I think again gets to the racial and ethnic component of this, that whites somehow feel entitled to this superiority, that they have a right to their scooters. They have a right to these different programs. But they don't want to see the colored people having these things. They're sort of freeloaders and lazy. So there's a certain element of racism that I think pervades this. And so these folks are being essentially, I guess they're being convinced to, in many ways, cut programs that benefit themselves without really kind of understanding it.
Right.
As it's been has been noted quite often, some of the southern states that seem most angry about the federal government are the major beneficiaries of the largesse of the federal government, that people from places like Connecticut or California or Massachusetts or in Northern Virginia are putting much more money in to the federal system than they get, and that money then goes to somewhat equalize the economic differences of the country. So the South being historically one of the poorer sections of the country, more until recently much more agricultural, not as industrial, that the South has gotten a disproportionate amount of money to maintain its standard of living. Now, so it's kind of ironic that some of these people have been worked up into such a frenzy about this idea that the federal government is sort of like the British crown and must be fought and resisted, are the same people often benefiting from the federal government. So it's there's a lot of muddled thinking. I think overall the libertarian side wants to see, which is the Koch brothers and people of that type, they want to see less federal government because they want less federal regulation. They want to be able to conduct their business. In the case of the Kochs, it's mostly energy, oil, gas, natural gas, etc. They want to be able to conduct their business without these, you know, environmental rules and all the rest of it. So they have a much clearer, I think, sense of what their purpose is. But they need these other Americans to kind of provide them the numbers to elect like-minded people to Congress and to provide the demonstrations and rallies and so forth. So they've sort of pulled those people in by helping to develop this idea that those folks are somehow speaking for the American founders, and there's this sort of there's this link between what they're doing today in terms of resisting the federal government,
right,
to what George Washington did in fighting the federal government. The fact that George Washington was a tremendous advocate of a strong federal government is sort of lost on them.
Yeah, and there are those on the hard right, also known as the Republican Party these days, which say that Obama and the non-Tea Party people are trying to transform the country and have more centralized power. And, you know, we've seen the signs, and it's frankly easy to poke fun of the protest signs saying, "Government hands off my Medicare." But, you know, I think you mentioned earlier the election of Ronald Reagan, and there was a very concerted, intentional assault on funding for public education starting in the 1980s. It seems to me, and there were, I remember some articles way back then saying that, well, that would guarantee more Republicans in the future. And, you know, without the education of real American history, this kind of thing happens, unfortunately. But it seems like it was intentional that, you know, you go back in time, you know, the feudal governments, the openly plutocratic governments, certainly were afraid of an educated public. They didn't want an educated public. And that does seem to be kind of a divide that still goes on. And, you know, I wonder how much the... you know, Reagan is generally these days looked upon as you know, almost a saint. I mean, he's people look back to him. The right certainly looks back to him as one of their great leaders. How significant was the presidency of Ronald Reagan on what we now see the right-wing Tea Party?
Well, I think it was very significant. I think it was, first of all, Reagan was the one who, when he came into power, said in his first inaugural, the government is the problem.
That's right.
And that had become sort of the touchstone to this entire movement, that government is the problem. That isn't really true, but it is, but because Reagan was then sort of elevated, and we watched some of this happen. I mean, his presidency was really not all that successful, and in most ways you could measure. I mean, it was really the it wasn't the beginning of sort of the collapse of the middle class. That had sort of begun a bit in the 70s with the oil shocks and the higher prices for cost of living and so forth, but it certainly accelerated in the 1980s with the breaking down of the unions and the weakening of various other parts of this of the New Deal system that had been that had actually created the American middle class as we know it in modern times.
Right.
So Reagan was played a very important role in bringing that along, creating more and more desperation. In a sense, he also solidified the idea of the Republicans being the party of the white South.
Mm-hmm.
After him, it was pretty much they were the red states. At least they were a key part of the red states. And then after he left, and especially in 1994, after the Republicans sweep win Congress, there was because of rejection of some of Bill Clinton's efforts at health care reform and other things and some tax increases. The Republicans win, and then they proceed in 95, 96, and through the 90s to name as many things as they can after Ronald Reagan. They turned him into a national icon.
Right.
And so he no longer was this figure, in many ways a very sinister figure, someone who was has more and recently been implicated in the genocide that has now been acknowledged in Guatemala in the early to mid 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
He was a big supporter of some of these awful death squad operations that swept Latin America.
Yes.
He was supporting it even in the 1970s when he was a newspaper commentator, and then he continued it, working with the Argentines. Intelligence services, for instance, in the early 1980s, setting up the Contras in Nicaragua. So Reagan had a very sinister, dark side, as well as kind of harming, generally speaking, the American middle class. But he has been elevated into, as you say, this iconic status, and so many of these Tea Partiers simply believe as almost as an article of faith.
Right.
That Reagan was a great president. I would personally argue, based on a lot of information I could bring forward if we had the time,
yeah,
that he was one of the worst presidents of in American history. He helped to pave the way to the George W. Bush presidency, and who simply more or less continued many of the policies that Reagan had done, to the point of the mess that we ended up with in the Middle East, as well as with the economy. But he does remain this icon.
And he certainly is still having an impact. And our guest today, Robert Perry, knows a little bit about Ronald Reagan, having worked to break the Iran-Contra story and uncover Oliver North's involvement in it back when he was a correspondent for Newsweek. And he has since established Consortium News to keep investigative journalism alive. We're talking about the Tea Party's claims to the mantle of American patriotism. And I wonder about, you know, there has been anger that the Obama administration bailed out the big banks, but where's mine? You know, and that the government seems to be largely owned by the wealthy powers. And people, not just on the right, but are kind of angry about that. And I wonder if the Tea Party demands that government really be more attentive to the interests of the common good. Is that a term they would use, the common good, or would that be something that they see as some kind of evil thing?
Well, I think they would reject the idea of the federal government doing pretty much anything. That certainly is, if you look at what the Tea Party caucus in the U.S. Congress has been doing. It is essentially to say that they want the federal government to be inert. They don't want it to do anything to help the public or to regulate business, to build roads. I mean, it's almost going back to that sort of period that we saw in the pre-Civil War days of the 1800s, when the South did not want the federal government to even provide disaster relief for fear that that would become a precedent for abolishing slavery. So we're seeing something similar, this kind of totally anti-government extremism that I think actually is quite un-American. And if you look at it in the context of what the American framers, if you're going back to the people that wrote the Constitution, their view was to have a vibrant central government to build this country and to protect its independence. That's what Washington was most concerned about. He felt that if the Articles of Confederation were allowed to continue, the country would disintegrate, that various European powers would pick off parts of it by developing alliances with certain states. He was a very important central actor in providing the moral and political authority to have the Constitutional Convention, where Madison's ideas worked often with working in tandem with Washington and with Hamilton, put together this idea of a strong central government, and as they wrote in the Constitution, one of the key points was to act on behalf of the national welfare, the common good. But these are concepts now that the Tea Party has essentially rejected.
Oh yeah.
So I would argue that the Tea Party is not really representing the Constitution. They say they are, but they don't understand the Constitution. They really are representing the Articles of Confederation. And they've been convinced that somehow the Articles of Confederation are the Constitution, or vice versa. So they've bought into this false narrative, where they don't understand why the framers met in Philadelphia at all. They've been convinced that this is some kind of almost a mystical, quasi-religious thing. That this is almost divinely inspired. This is a position that. And even Mitt Romney expressed during the last campaign that he said that he considers the Constitution to be nearly divine, God-inspired. It really wasn't. It was a set of compromises.
Yes, big compromises.
By people with various interests.
Very much so.
It turned out in many ways to have very, very bad aspects to it. There were compromises that probably were necessary in 1787 to get the country to stay together.
And
that was a key point that Washington and Madison had in mind.
And the struggle between the farmers, the debtors who at Shays' Rebellion and the Whiskey Rebellion and so many others, versus the creditors who had lent money to pay for the War of Independence, wanted their money back, it was a compromise. Each side wanted to win, but it was a continued compromise, and it has been ever since. And as we mentioned, the concept of the common good, how the big federal government helped tremendously to build the middle class and to build the common good under Franklin Roosevelt, with some prompting, I have to say, from Louisiana Governor Huey Long, who wanted to share the wealth. That's the enemy of the Tea Party these days, the idea that there is a common good, that the federal government can be a force for good. They don't want that at all. And I have to bring up, there was in the online discussion of your article, one person writes, and this is a little bit long, so bear with me, without the wonderful and progressive centralized government, we would never enjoy a militarized police state or surveillance state, a failed war on poverty, prohibition of alcohol and now many drugs, corporate welfare and bailouts, perpetual military engagement around the world, databases on citizens, assassinations of American citizens based on secret evidence, trillions of dollars in debt left for future generations, what this person claims are unsustainable social programs, regulation that benefit big business by eliminating competition from small business, federal harassment of citizens based on political beliefs unpopular by those holding office at any particular time, the largest incarceration rate in the world, a nation that is the biggest arms profiteer in the world, government-regulated health care, which I think is okay personally, and education that maintains the highest cost in the world, freedom for war criminals and white-collar criminals, and so many other wonderful things. Robert Perry, your reaction to that. Are these bad things that came as a result of the federal government? If the Tea Party had its way, would these things go away, these big problems?
Well, I think it's like just throwing everything possible you can imagine. But a key point is this, and this is something that I think the Tea Party has completely sort of forgotten or has been expunged from their memory, and that is that the middle class that we know today was the creation of the New Deal and some of the programs that were put in after World War II. Things like not only things like Social Security and the various TVA kinds of programs that helped spread electricity and wealth to parts of the country that were without these things, but also things like the GI Bill that followed the World War II. My dad was able to go back to college and really move up the ladder a bit because he was able to take advantage of the GI Bill. He bought his first house using some of the loans available that way. Going into the 60s, the efforts to have Medicare, so older people can actually live out their lives with some dignity.
Right.
You had efforts to eliminate racial segregation that the federal government oversaw and really directed that would not have been done if left to the states, clearly. The southern states would probably still maintain slavery if they had their way. So yes, you can. Are there problems with American democracy and the way it works? Without question, is there an absence of good independent journalism, for instance, that should be looking at things in a much more objective and professional way? I would say yes. We try to do what we can at the place I run, but it's very limited. And so yes, are there a lot of things that should be done differently? Of course, but to ignore the fact that there's many of the people that are now protesting actually have benefited enormously from some of the progressive positions taken by the federal government, especially during the Roosevelt era and going into the Eisenhower era and through LBJ and the building of some of the great society programs. These are benefits that people take for granted. That doesn't mean that the U.S. population should not act more aggressively in terms of addressing some of the problems.
Right.
But part of that is also from the right. The right has been the movement, especially through the control of the Supreme Court, that has unleashed massive amounts of dark money into our political process to buy up the politicians. There has been an acceptance through the period of the Cold War and the efforts to engage in McCarthyism. That was a big factor in helping to create this very uncontrollable military-industrial complex. So when people from the right sort of try to cherry-pick some of these problems, they often ignore the fact that they were central to causing them. And then turn around and denounce the whole system. But sure, of course, the American people, through the Republic, through the democratic processes that we have, which are certainly imperfect, should do a lot more to correct some of these problems and address them. But I'm not sure what the answer this person has would suggest. Anarchy, going back to having the Articles of Confederation, where maybe the restoration of slavery, you know, what does this person want, really?
Yeah, it's so much easier to tear things down than to build things up. And we need, as you say, more investigative journalism, more education, And these are things that the Tea Party is very much against. And Robert Perry, you say that, you know, the Tea Party has, as you say, as we opened the show, an ideological hatred of government. That seems to be so clearly the case without really understanding it. How in trouble is the idea of the republic, the common good? The Democrats don't seem to be, you know, focusing on this. They're like so often just sort of imitation Republicans, Republican light, if you will. And I wonder if, you know, the population in general is strong enough to resist this really radical plutocratic assault on the republic itself. You have any degree of optimism, Robert Perry?
Well, as a journalist, you try to deal with facts as you see them. So optimism is not usually part of the equation here. But the obviously, there's a lot that needs to be done. And I think we do have a system which is, as I said, imperfect. And many of those imperfections do go back to the founding as well. I mean, the overrepresentation of agricultural states, for instance, in the Senate. States with very little population still have two senators. So does California or New York. And those are compromises that were part of this original deal. So sure, there are problems. And, maybe if you could start over again and you could do something better. But realistically, we have to sort of work within what we've got.
Right.
And I think within that, there's still a lot of good that can be done. But I don't think that by providing a false history to deceive ill-informed Americans about how they need to be at war with their own government, a Republican form of government, that is particularly healthy either. I know it may be a way to sort of rally people to get angry and to show up at demonstrations. I guess there's some people want to have guns to bring to some march on Washington.
Mm-hmm.
You can try to bring about this chaos and violence, but there's, I think, decent people need to recognize that what the framers really tried to do was to create a system where those differences could be worked out peacefully.
Right.
That's really the core of what Madison and Jefferson and Washington and Hamilton were about. They had differences as it developed, as they moved through whether there should be a national bank or not, and things of that sort. But the overriding point was that the American people should be able to work out their differences through this political process, this imperfect political process.
And
as they went, they could make it more perfect. They could improve it. They could allow blacks to vote. They could allow women to vote. They could expand these kinds of rights. But that was a way to try to evolve and to grow and to improve as a nation. Now, if people want to throw that out and simply go and get their guns out of their basement and go shoot people, well, that's a whole different thing. But people should not pretend that the framers wanted that.
No.
The framers did not want that. In fact, the framers specifically address that in the Constitution, and they call it treason.
Yes, they do.
And they actually provide for the president of the United States to put down those kinds of insurrections. At that point, that he could federalize militias, and that's what happened with the Whiskey Rebellion. You had the framers expressly describing what they think about this idea that the Tea Party is, some people in the Tea Party are now spreading, this idea of violent revolution. It was called treason against the Republic, against the Constitution of the United States.
And certainly what the founders wanted was self-government. Citizenship is not a spectator sport. It's there. It takes a little bit of effort to get involved to govern ourselves. Very interesting show today, Robert Perry. What's the website for Consortium, your e-zine dedicated to investigative journalism?
Well, it's consortiumnews.com.
consortiumnews.com. And the new book is America's Stolen Narrative. Robert Perry, thank you very much for being with us. Very informative about the past and perhaps the future. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to go out on with a little bit of a new song by Joe Satriani called Lies and Truths. Thanks very much for listening.